morning and welcome to the Sports Polygamy Podcast. I'm Eric George and it's the 13th of November 2012. For his semi-farewell podcast, I have brought back my main lover, Kirk Dalziel. How are you, Kirk?
Not great, Eric. And since we're going to be talking about retirements today, I should probably declare my retirement from drinking. I had a Bucks party on the weekend and I came up worse for wear. My knee's swollen, my body hurts, my skin hurts. I'm not sure I can feel the left-hand side of my body.
Does your soul hurt?
Yeah, everything hurts. It was tough, and I'm glad I'm not the one getting married. What an idiot.
Do you feel like this will just be another one of your classic situations where you say, I'm going to go out and I'm not going to drink, and that means I'm going to have 6 beers rather than 50?
Well, maybe, but we'll see what happens if I meet up with Jay Cutler while I'm over in San Francisco while they play the 49ers. Then I may have 1,000 beers with him.
Yeah, hopefully he has a sweet moustache by then. He looked like he had a pretty good one on the way today. Anyway, like I said, I figured as this was going to be your last podcast potentially for a little while before you jet set around America to meet celebrities, we could talk about sporting retirements because it's something that obviously is pretty regular occurrence in sport. You could almost say it's an annual occurrence. So people seem to take very different approaches when they have to call it quits. And the one that I think interests me the most when you compare different sports is whether players seem to find it necessary to retire at their peak or whether players kind of hang around, make heaps of money, because realistically you can make a lot of money even after your peak in sport, and perhaps take a role on a bench or in a mentoring role or in a coaching role or something like that. Do you have a preference, Kirk, in what you prefer to see players do here?
I'm a big fan of the retired just after your peak scenario. Otherwise, you could turn to Ricky Ponting, who once again was solid for 5 whole deliveries. But look, my analogy being a property man is it's like the property market. If you've got an investment property and you've gone past the peak and you can see it starting to dip, just dump it and lose a little bit, rather than losing a shitload. And that's what happens if you're a star that sticks around and becomes borderline irrelevant, is that people stop caring and it can really tarnish your reputation, Brett Favre.
Yeah, but by the same token, if you're Brett Favre, you can either retire and become some, oblivious nobody in Louisiana or wherever he lives, or you can stay on for an extra 5 or 6 years and get paid squillions of dollars a year for average production. While you still can actually physically stand up. People still paid him money.
I understand the money side of things, but surely if you're somebody like Favre or even Ricky Ponting, like if you're one of these guys that has been in the league for 10 or 12 years, no matter what sport you're in, you've got to have already made a hell of a lot of money through endorsements and everything else. So I can't see it being purely about the money. I just don't know if they know how to let go sometimes.
Yeah, that's certainly an element of it for sure. It's the fact that, especially now, I think it's going to be probably more of a case of current sportsmen's generations, whether these kids coming through now have been playing essentially professional level, sport in terms of time commitment since the age of 4 or 5 up until the age of 35, if they're good, or 40, and they just don't have anything else in their life. And you can see that kind of in some of the guys who hung around too long in various sports. They're often the ones who just don't seem to have outside interests. So they potentially try to leave like Favre did, and then they announce their comeback because they get horrified by the thought that they might get bored.
Yeah, but it's sad when they lose it, though. I mean, it's like watching a boxer just getting pulverized in the corner. It becomes ugly and unsightly. And it's sad because these people, especially kids' heroes and people's heroes, and then the end of their career is just sullied by vitriol and anger from fans that they didn't go sooner, rather than going out at a higher level where people praise them and say, what a wonderful career. Somebody like an Adam Gilchrist or Matthew Hayden, who were still great cricketers. And I mean, they showed that in the Big Bash leagues and all those sort of things, but they got out of international cricket at the right time. They were just starting to fall off the edge a little bit and said, no, we're done here.
Cricket's an interesting one because, obviously, the most high-profile level of that sport is the international level cricket, but it does actually provide essentially a way for players to wind down their career while still playing, because they can retire from different forms of the game while still essentially being a professional cricket player. It's almost like a Brett Favre, or perhaps more somebody like Mark Bolger, who was a starting quarterback for a long time. These guys who have the option of staying on a benching role and tutoring young guys. So Yeah, the example of cricket's a curious one because the actual structure of the sport allows guys to kind of withdraw from the spotlight without, you know, having to go completely cold turkey on the sport.
In rugby, I believe we call that Japan
Or France.
or France. So there are other avenues to, in some sports, to at least get taken out of the spotlight and go play somewhere else, and make a truckload of money while you're doing it. But if you're in a pretty niche sport, something like American football, it makes it pretty tough. Once you're done, you're pretty much done.
By comparison, I think if you look more, you know, closer to home, something like AFL, there's really nothing. Like, you're falling off the edge of a cliff. And I think that's potentially why you see guys, a lot of players, hanging on for a long time, and, you know, potentially playing well once their knees are clearly worn out and they look like a shadow of their former selves. But then, interesting, there's other guys like Scarlett this year, who, you know, retired without much pomp and circumstance. And he was still had games this year where he looked very good, but you could see that he was wearing out a little bit. He read the tea leaves and got out while he still could.
Yeah, it's a smart option. It's always sad when it's injury that ends a player's career as well. You want to see them play a full season or most of a season, rather like a Stirling Mortlock case, where he didn't really play much in those last few years, and I'm sure he's good as a mentor, etc. But as a fan, you wanted to see him finish on a high note, and he didn't play enough, I don't think.
Yeah, the Mortlock case is curious for a lot of reasons, like because, you know, as you said, he didn't play often. The games that he played, he was really kind of depressing to watch because his legs couldn't carry him anymore. But he was the most marketable player on that team, even though they had O'Connor and Beale and, you know, these young, exciting kids. Mortlock was the guy who got the fans excited because of, you know, his long career for the Wallabies. So he's fulfilled a role for the team in that respect. But the circumstances and the logistics of retiring are also interesting to consider. As you said, the worst case scenario, I think, definitely is early, you know, a career being drawn to a premature end by injury. I mean, it looked like that's what we get in the case of someone like Brandon Roy in the NBA last year until he came back this year, and we'll wait and see how that goes. But that's just the saddest thing when you see these guys, you know, having to pull the plug early because their body just can't handle it.
I think seeing somebody like Greg Oden, even somebody with a lot of potential, where you sit there and think, hey, gee, this guy could be great. And then you get constant injuries, and it's just little things to begin with. And then you get one big blowout, and it really damages their career and their confidence. And it's a shame when you want to see these freakish type players with really big bodies or some sort of freakish aspect, and you don't even get to see them reach their potential because they're brought down by injury as well.
Yeah, unfortunately, it is, I guess, a little bit of a phenomenon that you see with tall guys in basketball and sports like that. Obviously, you've got Yao Ming, or you can go back a little bit and see somebody like Bill Walton back in the 80s for the Trailblazers. These guys who could have potentially had very, you know, starring roles for a long time, but their bodies just couldn't carry them. So that's the worst case scenario. What if, you know, a player gets the feeling, Kirk, that his prowess isn't what he used to be, and he wants to pull the plug? Do you think he should announce it before the season, during the season, after his last game? You know, what's the way you like to see them do it?
I think I'd tend to the before the season. So this is my last season, and then fans get a chance to come out and see you, and they know it's probably going to be the last time they get to see you. I'm not a big ceremony guy, like holding big ceremonies for people to say, "Well, congratulations, I'm retiring." I'm more of a hold a press conference, have a little of a cry, thank everybody, and shoot off. But I like the farewell tours, I guess it was, where you get to play in front of your home crowd. Somebody like a Hindmarsh, who's been such a legend and a powerhouse for a team, that he gets the opportunity to play in front of packed stadiums and have people say thank you.
Yeah, you could make an argument that there's a selfish angle to that, but perhaps they've earned it. Maybe it depends on the player. If it's somebody like Hindmarsh, who's been a real servant of his game for a long time, you can certainly say that he earns the right to have fans come out from around the nation and essentially come to see him play his last game rather than support the team. Because it's almost like when a coach says he's leaving the team before the end of the year's over. It kind of makes you think. It puts an added pressure and an added distraction on the team at the same time.
It can be detrimental, and it's never good. I mean, look what happened to India when they came over here, and Sachin was still trying to get his 100th 100,
Oh, man.
and he was saying it was his last time through Australia. But that's part of the reason I went down, was just to see Sachin Tendulkar. I'd never seen him live, and he didn't play particularly well, and I didn't see much of him. But it was good that he announced that this would be the last time he was coming to Australia, so fans got a chance to go down and see something truly spectacular. But it can't be somebody that's only played 5 years in the league, or has just been a bit of a hotshot for a few years. It's got to be one of those real stalwarts of the team that sort of epitomises your team's style, and then is stuck around, and a couple of generations can relate to him.
So, what about the whole ceremony thing? You said you're not a big fan of the pomp and the, you know, the whole ceremony of it. So, what do you want them to do? You don't like the press conference? Do you like it to be done on field? What do you want?
I don't mind the press conference. I think the press conference is a good chance to get out and say thank you to the people that they've encountered in their time, coaches and family and fans, etc. And it gets broadcast live and over the news and all the rest of it. I'm a big fan of the leave him by himself while the teammates go off and do their own thing, and he gets to walk around the boundary and shake hands with the fans. I'm a big fan of that.
Kids as well. Get the kids out there.
Get the kids out there. Always get the kids out. That's a tearjerker. But just spend some time with the fans. I mean, a lot of them have spent a lot of money coming to see you, and they have really appreciated what they do. For a lot of people, sports is their big thing in life. So just a little bit of recognition, and then it gives them a chance to say thank you to the player as well for such special moments, etc.
Do you think it's you know, expected that they cry? Do you feel cheated if they don't cry?
No, I don't feel cheated if they cried, Eric. Come on. Some people do get the waterworks out, and that's fine. It's a big part of their lives, and it's a bit different to just having your day job where you leave and, you know, you couldn't really give a shit. But you're leaving people that you've played with for a long time.
No, I'm saying, do you feel cheated if they don't cry?
Oh, no, I don't feel cheated if they don't cry.
Don't you want them to mean something to them, Kirk? Don't you want them to be devastated like you are if they're leaving?
Yeah, but I don't cry when they leave the team, Eric. Look, you don't need to cry to show somebody that it means something to you. And the fact that you're holding a press conference and even talking about it shows you cared. If you didn't care, you'd just walk off and tell them all to lick your stink eye.
Perhaps there is a little bit of Matty Scarlett in there where he walked off without any kind of cheering or anything, but I guess getting flogged by Fremantle doesn't help that whole angle.
Look, some people aren't big media people anyway. I mean, Scarlett was never in the media constantly or talking himself up or talking the team up or anything. He was quite a quiet guy during his whole career. So I wasn't surprised that he didn't have huge celebration at the end of it. So, probably had a few frothies, I imagine.
Yeah, I can imagine he would have. Well, one thing I always find interesting is the reaction after players retire. I think you can – although there obviously is always a lot of rose-tinted glasses and a lot of retrospective – kind of rewriting of history when players retire, they tend to brush over stuff or whatever. But it's interesting to see, I think, always the reaction of fans from opposing teams, from potentially, you know, the enemy lines to a player to I think it's a really good indicator of the class and the quality of a player once he's retiring. And the great example I always dig up for this, especially from your perspective as a Kiwi, Kirk, is George Smith, who I think a lot of people – I saw a lot of people, you know, around the world kind of commenting that when he retired from Wallabies play, that was the passing of a great, you know, modern Wallaby.
He was a really good player. And I agree as well. When George Smith came to an end, it was a pretty sad day for rugby because he was a tough man. And I think that's what transcended my hatred of Australia, being a New Zealander, obviously, in rugby sense, is that he was just such a tough nut, and he was always clean, and he was always a really nice guy. But you put him on the field and he'll belt the snot out of people, and he was a good, tough bloke. And that sometimes in sport, people can just not be level-headed and just dislike players because they're on a certain team. But I think you're right. A true sign of greatness is when people can sit there and say, wow, this guy is tremendous. I imagine it's what it would have been like watching the Chicago Bulls when Michael Jordan was playing. Sure, he was on another team and he was just about to completely destroy them. But deep down, you'd actually want to see him score 50 on your team.
So who do you think that's around now that would get that kind of universal appeal when they retire? Because I think it's not only the class of the player as a player, but it's also the class of the player as a person, because they get that respect for just not being a douchebag through their whole career as well.
look, in rugby, I'd probably say Richie McCaw would be the big... and I think... Well, not even an obscure reference, but Brian O'Driscoll would be another one in rugby because he's been a stalwart of Irish rugby, and he's really good and really tough. So I think in a rugby sense, those would definitely be two of them.
Yep. That's true. Do you have any other notable ones you can think of? Australians or South Africans or anything like that across sports? People who you know should have disliked by the end, you couldn't help but respect.
Oh, you're making it tough here. I think you used to Von der Westhuizen when I was growing up, watching rugby, the great scrum half for South Africa. I really wanted to dislike him, but it was tough. He was such a flashy, good player in a rugby sense. Same with Fredrik Mishelak. I wanted to hate him, but
He
he
hasn't
was
even
just.
retired yet. He just gutted us for 10 million points on the weekend.
I know, but he'll be retiring soon, so that'll be a sad day.
Yeah.
Look, in cricket, it was sad when Gilchrist and Matty Hayden left. They were such powerful, destructive batters, and we hadn't really seen anything on that level before. And Hayden says he was just so massive and so domineering at the crease. And then Gilchrist had all the flair and big sweeping left-handed slog sweeps and all the rest of
Surely there's another cricketer who you have missed a lot more.
it. Jesse Ryder?
No, an Australian, Kirk.
Who, Eric?
Spin
Tell me.
bowler, come on.
Oh, Warnie.
Yeah. Is there anybody you've missed more than Warnie?
Yeah, I do miss Warnie. I remember watching a documentary a while ago about the Ashes in 2005 when they lost, but there was an incredible sequence where he describes two overs that he bowled to Ian Bell where he just completely mind fucked him. He was saying, "I bowled this ball to do this and this ball to do that," and then he said, "And then I bowled the flipper just to sk skip one through, and it just clean bowls him." I was like, "You're incredible." And I also miss his off-field antics as well. It was thoroughly entertaining listening to him double team page three models while he had a wife and kids and all the rest of it. What, does that make me a bad person all of a sudden? Come on,
No,
I'd
it
be.
makes Warnie your idol. That's what it makes him. So yeah, that's the whole process of retiring. And as you know, as we said, it is the test of a player, I guess, at the reaction he gets when he retires. But what about after that, Kirk? What do we think about comebacks? Because they happen quite a bit. I mean, you mentioned Jordan before. He did it twice, once more successfully than another. With Brett Favre as well, we mentioned he did it about 10 times. Warnie kind of did it, but how do you feel about comebacks in sport?
I don't mind a player coming back, but you need to. This is fraught with danger. You need to be really careful that if you're a sportsman, because you can get out of shape very, very quickly. I mean, even just from a non-athletic person like myself, if I go running for a couple of weeks, I feel kind of good, and then one big night in the booze, and I'm back to square one again. So there is a realistic chance that you make yourself look like a bit of a muppet if you come back. And Ian Thorpe was obviously a brilliant case in point, but another one as well. That was really sad was Jonah Lomu when he's back, and that was depressing to watch because back in his day he was just such a powerful man, and he was just crushing people, running over people. But by the time he made his comeback, everyone else had got to a similar size. The game had caught up to him, so suddenly he was a similar size, and you actually realised that he was possibly the least talented player to ever step onto a rugby field, and it was sad.
Jonah Lomu was almost a nightmare scenario for a comeback because he never really relied on skill at all, like you suggested. He was really just relied on the physical advantages that his body gave him. And the thing is, once these players retire, they have to move quickly just to stay in one place because it's not like the sport goes into stasis when they leave. The game, as you said, gets bigger, it gets more complex, it gets faster. So they need to be working doubly as hard just to keep up if they're going to come back. And generally, it seems like that's not what happens.
And once again, it gets down to legacy, I guess. And you can really tarnish your legacy by coming back and failing in such a public way. And it can't do wonders for your morale and insanity, really. But then again, you can get great comebacks and great stories. Somebody like a Kurt Warner that came out of the European League in football and then came back again and had another shot at a Super Bowl. I mean, that was to watch.
I mean, you already mentioned it before, but boxing really is the pits when it comes to this stuff because there should be a law in boxing. Like, they should actually make it a rule that once you've retired, you're done. You cannot come back because it never ends well. I can't ever think of cases. I mean, I'm certain that there are some, but it seems more often than not, the guys who come back, they're doing it for the wrong reasons and they get the living crap beaten out of them, and it's depressing to watch.
Yeah, Tyson got lit up in his last one because he just came back for money and even said it that he did. But I'm pretty sure Evander Holyfield's still boxing. I'm pretty sure I heard that he had another fight on the cards. But you're right, there should be a rule that once you're gone, you're gone. And there should be some kind of age limit to how long you're allowed to get punched in the head. If you're 40 years old and still walking in there and getting knocked in the melon, somebody should just step in and say, "Son, it's done."
Yeah, and Tyson's a good example of this. Ali as well, obviously. is perhaps the starkest example of this, because he was such a lively, you know, vivacious character when he was young, and then by the end of his career, when he was just doing these weird, you know, exhibition fights in Japan and stuff like that, he was this really sluggish, old, fat, kind of slightly disfigured boxer who didn't even resemble the character that everyone wants to remember him as. So when it comes to legacy as well, a naked sport like boxing, where, you know, there's no option in boxing for you to come back and like we suggested before, you know, play that mentoring role and make some money by playing rugby in Japan, you're out there and you're getting hit in your own head.
Yeah, that's it. You got no one else to blame as well. No one to hide behind or just play bits and pieces. Once you're out there, it's a free-for, and you can get really lit up and get seriously damaged as well. It's not like going out and playing rugby and you pull your groin because you're an old man, but you're going out and getting punched in the head, and your head can only take so much of it.
I guess by the same token, we say all this, but as sports fans, we call for comebacks constantly. I mean, Warnie, I'm sure there'll still be multiple, you know, back page articles on the Herald Sun this summer as Australia struggles through tests about how we should, you know, how can we get Warnie back into the test side again? And it's the same in plenty of sports. I mean, I remember there was talk in this Super Rugby season when the stocks for the Brumbies fly halves got so thin, they were talking about bringing Stephen Larkham out of retirement. I mean, people love to fantasize about this stuff, so you can kind of hardly blame these players sometimes for considering it when they have it thrown at them as a suggestion all the time.
I thought Stephen Larkham couldn't even walk in a straight line by the time he finished his career. He'd been belting the head that many times. But look, so some players do come back. Tony Brown and Andrew Merton's had pretty long careers and had a couple of comebacks. And Case Mews came back, even though he was a bit fatter and slower. I mean, he was still useful.
Ollie LaRue.
What a fat unit he was. And I remember watching Craig Dowd in 2005 play in Scotland. So I mean, they do get around the traps, and the comeback's fine, but you've got to be very careful, Eric.
But so why do you think it is that fans are so obsessed with doing it, though? I mean, why is it that we as fans, when things go wrong, obviously the smart decision is, okay, the team looks a bit thin, we should be focusing on our youth and getting a more stable future for the team. But it's not that. It's like, bring back Warnie. Why do you think that's the knee-jerk reaction all the time?
Because we're idiots, Eric.
I was hoping you wouldn't say that.
Yeah, well, it is, and you don't want to move on. It's like being in a bad relationship. Sure, your girlfriend keeps cheating on you, etc., but you sit there and you're like, oh, but I love her.
Yeah.
So it's that similar sort of mentality where you just can't move on, and it's easier to look at the here and now rather than focus on the future, which may or may not be bright. I mean, the future is something that is unpredictable, whereas if you get some guy back that you at least feel solid, it's like a security blanket almost.
It's much easier to just cry while you look at your commemorative plate from the Ashes from 15 years ago.
Exactly. Bring back Steve Waugh.
Yeah. Oh, God. Don't say that. So comebacks, not, you know, potentially not the best idea all the time. But what about post-career careers for sports people? Because we suggested that it can be a tough thing sometimes. It seems to be something that teams are spending a bit of money on now, is trying to develop their players into having something other than, you know, being meatheads, so that they don't get completely depressed when they retire. I think we can both agree that we don't want them to all go on TV because it's kind of killing Australian sports media. So what do you reckon? Own a pie car, secondhand car dealership? What do you like seeing them doing, Kirk?
Pubs, Eric.
Yeah.
Sports pubs. A sportsman knows how to make a good sports pub. I remember the Holy Grail in Christchurch that was run by Andrew Mertens and Justin Marshall. Sure, it went broke, but man, it was a great place to go watch some sport. Also, sportsmen and sportsmen and alcohol all go hand in hand, along with off-field indiscretions. So at least if you're there, you're in pleasant company when you're doing something stupid.
So Andrew Mertens ran a sports bar.
Oh yeah, man, he got around it big time. They had so many TVs in there. That's probably why they went broke. It was literally just one large TV.
Could you bring your daughter there so he could have sex with her?
That was his thing. That's what he liked to do.
So. It's potentially not the most mature suggestion, but I think it's a very Kirk Dalziel one, so I'm glad you brought it up. I don't think we can suggest that all sports people should go out there and start becoming publicans.
Oh, no, but Ben Cousins shouldn't be within 100 miles of a pub.
But, yeah, I mean, the pie things stand. I mean, Artie Beetson was a very successful pie person. You see, you know, it's clearly in Adelaide, it seems to be some rite of passage where once a crow retires, he gets a secondhand Toyota dealership somewhere. But I think
Tane Randall had a sandwich shop for a while.
Really?
Yeah, so maybe they're like getting down all about the food as well.
But the thing that I find interesting is how some players really managed to do a good job of transitioning to alternate careers. I mean, John Eales is clearly a very successful person in the corporate world. Kieran Perkins, I think, works for the NAB despite his, you know, recent private personal issues or whatever that got dragged through the paper. He seems to have done a pretty good job of maintaining a squeaky corporate image and kind of getting involved in the banking world. Do you think that this is something we'll see more of, Dalziel? As you know, these kids are kind of spending more time in a marketed environment, that they're, you know, they're going to be looking at different careers.
I think the days of sportsmen being idiots and just, well, not being particularly intelligent, just incredibly athletic, are done and gone. I mean, I remember not that long ago, in fact, when Tane Randall was captain of the All Blacks, that every one of the forwards had a degree, including the props. And I think Case Muse even was a sculptor, which was odd. So they become educated. They become highly educated. Richie McCaw's a fully qualified pilot. So I think because the game's become so complex with breakdowns and analysis and all the rest of it, the players have actually got to be incredibly intelligent, as well as being physically superior to everybody else. So I think the days of sportsmen being dropkicks is dead and gone, unless you play rugby league and then you just need to be massive.
Well, and just also in this era of sportsmen being brands and all that, they've, you know, clearly spent a lot more time fixing up their persona and their, you know, diction and all that kind of stuff. All the ones that are focused on that at least seem to spend more time on it.
Well, put it this way, if Sonny Bill Williams didn't have a rockin' body, nobody would be marketing him.
What, you don't like his sexy voice?
I think he only knows four words.
Left hook, right hook.
Offload.
Yeah. Dear. So what about... what about public speaking? I mean, that's kind of a good... I think you have had to have had a pretty damn good career for you to get on that public speaking tour. But if you were, you know, the Australian's captain of the cricket team, of the national cricket team, or, you know, you won a flag or something like that, I think you've got a pretty solid career on that corporate circuit just doing inspirational speeches for a while.
There's huge money in this. There's just incredible amounts of money, especially if it's one of the charismatic guys. If you're somebody... that can tell a good yarn, that helps as well, and you can get into the pub scene and tell yarns at pubs. But think about it this way. How much money would you pay to go and listen to John Eales for an hour?
Yeah, this is a perfect example, because I agree. I would pay lots of money. He has the worst speaking voice. Just terrible.
No, you don't need a good speaking voice, as long as you can tell a good story. Yeah, I mean, he'd true. Be able to tell a good story. I mean, you watch him with his... I remember you sending me a message when you saw him doing sideline reporting with no notes or anything and just spoke for about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And just about everything. I mean, the guy's incredibly intelligent and knowledgeable. So I think just even hearing his knowledge, but then I'd pay a lot to go listen to Andrew Mertens as well. He's, I don't know if he's that intelligent, but God damn it, it'd be funny.
Martin Johnson, I think, would be another good example of that. The English captain who won the World Cup. I've seen him do a number of speeches, and he's a very eloquent guy. So, yeah, I mean, the other reality is the people who are often paying for these things, especially the people who are paying a lot of money for these things, really like sport. So just the ability to be in the same room as a guy who won a trophy that they got excited about is something they're probably going to shell out significant coin for.
Oh, yeah. And the last one's coaching, Eric. I mean, that's the next progressive step, because especially here in Australia, unless you've played at a high level, there's no way anyone will employ you to coach, because you clearly have no idea what you're doing. But if you've played and have no idea what you're doing, somebody will still pay shitloads for you to come and coach their team. Who cares if you run the team into the ground, but you have somebody that used to play this one time.
We'll have to do this on another podcast, because I'm convinced that that's actually something that's going to change over the next 10 years in Australian sport. But you're right. Right now, it seems to be Australian sports coaches are purely stocked by recently retired players. It seems like, you know, for example, currently Fremantle's, you know, obsessed with picking up all of Sydney's premiership players by hiring Brett Kirk and a couple of other guys to go over and help Ross Lyon over in Frio. But it's, once again, I guess it's almost another way of kind of phasing players out of a sporting life where they can kind of stay in that environment without the physical toll on their body. But they can still kind of be in that team atmosphere.
Yeah, but it's fraught with danger as well. I mean, you could easily get somebody who actually doesn't know how to deal with personnel whatsoever, and all you then end up with is a big name that really knows squadouche, and it doesn't help your team at all.
Yeah, that is a problem. That is a problem. Well, I think there might be a chance, Kirk, that we can touch bases while you're jet setting around America, ticking off your sporting bucket list. But if we don't, enjoy yourself, and I look forward to catching up with you in December in person.
Yeah, it's cool, man. I'll try and get a locket of Jay Cutler's hair for you.
Oh my God, I don't think I'd ever wash again if you could do that. I would find a way of like tracing it onto my body and then getting a tattoo or something.
No, just get it plugged into your head. Just get some hair plugs. Jay Cutler hair plugs.
Then I'll get graft versus host syndrome though. Anyway. Anyway, as usual, you can follow this podcast at sportspolygamy.com. You can also find us on Facebook and iTunes, where you can subscribe to keep track. Leave us any feedback on the blog or on the Facebook page. If you've got any feedback, we'd love to hear it. Until next time, I'm Eric George.
I'm Kirk Yelsey.
And that's Sports Polygamy. See ya.